why would Alaska sue to discriminate against people and families like mine?
Two lawmakers are working to enshrine anti-discrimination protections for fellow LGBTQ Alaskans. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 9th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Takotna is a popular place for rest, relaxation, and refueling along the Iditarod Trail.
I had banana cream pie, apple pie, and one I'm not even sure what it was. It was just good.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Democratic lawmakers in Alaska are trying to restore anti-discrimination protections for gay and transgender Alaskans after the state attorney general quietly rolled back those protections last summer. LGBTQ Alaskans say it's long overdue. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
Casey Kasort has been testifying for LGBTQ non-discrimination bills in Alaska since they were a teenager growing up in Fairbanks. Kasort, who identifies as queer and works as a field manager for Planned Parenthood Alliance advocates, says they've never trusted that the state would protect LGBTQ people, even while protections were briefly in place last year.
I've never trusted that my right to be able to do all of those things, get a job, be in the house, you know, I have been protected because they've always been at the whim of an attorney general.
An Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica investigation published last week revealed the attorney general directed the Alaska Commission for Human Rights to void equal protections for LGBTQ Alaskans in areas like housing and financing. On Wednesday, the state's first ever out queer lawmakers sponsored a bill in the Alaska House to enshrine anti-discrimination protections in law. Representative Jenny Armstrong, a West Anchorage Democrat who filed the bill, says it's both a human rights issue and an economic one for a state that is facing a deep labor shortage as people leave the state for opportunities elsewhere.
With 10 years of out-migration, I can tell you one thing that won't reverse that is, you know, not having equal rights for people. If you want to have more businesses invest in this state, you can't have a business come here when there's different employment protections in different parts of the state and different housing protections.
The rollback in protections occurred late last summer, according to the ADN investigation. Alaska's Attorney General Treg Taylor ordered the State Commission for Human Rights to remove sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination protections in all areas except employment matters. In an emailed statement, Taylor said the move was consistent with state law, which does not include sexual orientation or gender identity as protected classes. He said it's up to the legislature to expand the protections beyond employment matters. At the same time, under Taylor's leadership, Alaska is one of 20 states suing the federal government to block LGBTQ protections for people in schools and government jobs.
Why would Alaska sue to discriminate against people and families like mine?
Andrew Gray is an openly gay East Anchorage Democrat and a co-sponsor of the House bill. Gray says amid other recent actions from the Dunleavy administration, including proposals to limit the rights of gender nonconforming children in schools, the discrimination protections rollback feels like one piece of a socially conservative agenda.
To me, it's all part of the same cloth. It's bringing lower 48 issues to our state, and they're supplanting the very real issues that we need to be working on.
Gray and Armstrong acknowledge the bill will face an uphill battle in the Republican-controlled House this session. It still needs to pass through three committees before it comes to the House floor, and it's possible time will run out. Wasilla Republican Jesse Sumner chairs the Labor and Commerce Committee, where the bill currently sits. He says he needs to take a closer look, but could be in favor of the bill.
Possibly. I don't know that I'd be opposed.
other committee chairs, Democrat C.J. McCormick and Republican Sarah Vance, did not respond to requests for comment. In the meantime, Kasort, the Fairbanks field manager, says the fight for anti-discrimination protections can feel disheartening, but they're hopeful watching a new generation of queer lawmakers pushing for change.
I know so many young people who've moved out of the state because we don't feel safe here. But I also know so many queer and trans people who live here, and it's our home, and we're not leaving.
Senator Scott Kawasaki, a Fairbanks Democrat, is crafting a similar bill to create LGBTQ protections on the Senate side, but does not yet know when it will be introduced. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
On Tuesday, Governor Mike Dunleavy announced a bill that would restrict Alaska's LGBTQ students' ability to live in accordance with their gender identities at school. The bill would require parents to sign off on name and pronoun changes, and it would ban transgender students from using bathrooms that align with their gender identity. It's not likely to pass. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Republican, says he doesn't see a lot of support for it.
It takes 11 members to pass anything on the floor. I don't want to waste a lot of time on a bill that has no chance of passing the floor.
He says Dunleavy's bill will get heard, but it isn't a priority for the Senate Majority Caucus. Amelia Hanrahan is a Juno mental health clinician who works with queer and trans youth in Juno. She says that even a failed bill could affect the way trans students are treated by their peers.
I think just announcing this and validating this type of rhetoric against the queer and trans community is dangerous. And I can, you know, draw pretty straight lines from, like, you know, increases of this stuff in the media to bullying happening in our hallways here in the schools.
Hanrahan is queer and trans herself. She says there's no scientific basis for the proposal.
It was really conspicuous that the governor doesn't cite any professional organizations that support this idea, because there are no legitimate professional organizations that support this idea.
Hanrahan says that the American Psychological Association, as well as its counseling and psychiatric counterparts, support youth receiving gender-affirming care and support. A social media campaign is urging President Joe Biden to reject an oil development project on Alaska's North Slope. The hashtag Stop Willow campaign, mostly on TikTok, has tallied more than 50 million views. Its popularity reflects the unease that young Americans feel about climate change and their concern that Biden will not keep his campaign pledge to curtail oil drilling. Many Alaska Native leaders with ties to the petroleum-rich North Slope support ConocoPhillips Alaska's project, say they need the mitigation funds and jobs it would bring to remote villages. The Biden administration could announce its decision as early as this week. Meanwhile, this weekend marks the third anniversary of the World Health Organization's declaration of the global COVID-19 pandemic, and Juneau's wastewater is awash with the virus. Charlie Gribben is Bartlett Regional Hospital's disease preventionist. She says only about 3% of COVID tests are coming back positive in the hospital's lab, but the city and state no longer track cases closely, so most public health data gives an incomplete account of how many cases there are.
I would say that there are more cases being talked about than they're actually being confirmed.
But there is one metric Gribben said the public can rely on. Juneau's wastewater has more than four times the national average of COVID-19 in it.
I definitely take more impact from this because you're not relying on people to go get tested or tell you that they're sick, you know, or even know that they have any symptoms. Because in, you know, the healthy working well, they could just feel tired or have a headache.
Gribben says Bartlett has five employees out sick this week. She said healthy people may be infected and show only minor symptoms, but the hospital is still admitting an average of 1 to 3 people weekly with COVID-19.
COVID really is affecting people in their over age 65, and they're getting really sick and they're hypoxic and they're taking a long time to recover.
She said she thinks it's worth wearing masks in public if it means sparing older people from serious disease. Gribben says prevention is best, but antiviral medication is a useful tool for preventing serious illness if you do get COVID-19. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Unalaska's tribal government seeks community input to assess the city's climate vulnerability.
The local and indigenous knowledge that you have is science, regardless of what other people might say.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
One person died last night in a northeast Anchorage fire, which forced tenants from a 20-unit apartment building overnight. Anchorage Fire Department Assistant Chief Alex Boyd says crews responded to the blaze on the 400 block of North Burgos Street just after 8 p.m. One person was reported missing, but was soon found by police outside a second-floor unit.
And they moved that person to the fire crews who initiated care. The person was declared dead at the scene due to the level of injuries that they'd sustained.
Boyd says the victim hasn't yet been named. No other injuries were reported. Only the victim's unit burned in the blaze, according to Boyd, but water from fire hoses damaged several other units. Everyone living in the building was displaced last night, with the Red Cross of Alaska providing assistance. Investigators are still determining where and how the fire started.
It's unknown if there were working smoke alarms in the building or in the unit, the fire unit, at the time of the fire.
Firefighters urge residents to confirm smoke alarms are working and check their batteries. Wednesday's blaze was Anchorage's fifth fatal fire of the year. Meanwhile, the head of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness says some basic needs of people staying in city-funded emergency cold weather shelters are not being met. In a note Tuesday to some Anchorage Assembly members, Coalition Executive Director Meg Zalatel said that conclusion comes after fielding complaints since mid-December about issues at the Sullivan Arena, Alex Hotel, and Aviator Hotel. These facilities have been housing hundreds of people this winter with nowhere else to go. Zalatel said the most common complaints are about personal safety, hygiene, food, water, medical needs, and staff. Zalatel is also a member of the Assembly, though she recused herself from the Assembly's live deliberations on the topic Tuesday. In her note, she included an anecdote about a client who'd secured a job, but whose living situations in the Sullivan Arena and Alex Hotel were too unstable to keep it. Felix Rivera chairs the Assembly's Housing and Homelessness Committee.
This should be alarming to everyone in our community. People experiencing homelessness deserve better.
The municipality has been contracting with Henning Inc. to operate the three facilities as shelters this winter. The complaints and oversight issues come up as the Assembly was considering whether to continue funding Henning's contract through the end of April. The Assembly did approve spending another $4.6 million in alcohol taxes for these services, but it set aside $25,000 for third-party oversight. Sean Hayes is Henning's founder and CEO.
We were taken aback by it, but we welcome it. Because we do. We've always operated in transparency. And you know, we look forward to making any improvements that we need to make.
She acknowledged complaints, but said they've been promptly investigated and resolved. The Assembly's action requires publicly posting how to lodge complaints and concerns and regular reports to the Assembly and the administration. Each year during the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, dozens of dogs are left behind at checkpoints with illness or injuries, usually minor. These dogs are checked by veterinarians and then flown to Anchorage or Nome, where they're held until their mushers arrive. It's a routine process, but not without some mishaps in the past. Last year, a dog escaped after being dropped in Ruby and went missing for 3 months before he was recaptured more than 100 miles away in McGrath. Sebastian Dos Santos Borges's lost dog, Leon, inspired a new program in this year's race to attach GPS tracking devices to all dropped dogs. Dirsko von Feil, a veterinarian with the Iditarod, says the program is in a preliminary phase right now.
Basically, every dropped dog gets this tracker on, and then they're being tracked by people in Anchorage so that we can make sure we know where these dogs are.
After a musher drops the dog, vets Velcro a collar with a pocket for the tracking device to fit into.
Look at this. You put this on, And then you get a snack. What about that? You get to sit in the sun the whole nice day.
So, but it's really nice because just like in the human like rescue situations, right? You have these spot trackers. People can push the button, like the mushers have that on their sleds. And then you can exactly localize where the person is. Or in this case, they are sending on, they're sending out signals now all the time since we have them on their dogs. And then we know where they are and can track them best way.
Funfile says this year there are a few dozen trackers being tested, and the goal for the future is to put the trackers on all drop dogs. Meanwhile, Jesse Holmes currently leads the Iditarod with Brent Sass behind, having recently left the checkpoint in the community of Iditarod, where eight more mushers are resting. Nearly all teams in the race have completed their mandatory 24-hour rest and are back out on the trail to Nome. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan caught up with a few of them in Takotna as they finished their long break to hear about how they're feeling.
In the dog yard outside of the Takotna checkpoint, musher Bridget Watkins is getting rid of some ice that's frozen into her sled runners, her tool of choice, the back of a hand axe.
Even down here, see, like, look under my, see, there's ice, and that's all weight. So if you don't get that stuff out, it's just extra weight that you're trying to get out that you don't have to have.
Her sled is turned upside down to drain out the water from the rain the day before. But Watkins says overall she's had a pretty smooth race so far, especially compared with her rookie run last year, where she was forced to drop out due to bad weather shortly before the Nome finish line. Now in Takotna, she's made it about a third of the way into this race. She's one of the last mushers to leave the checkpoint after finishing her 24-hour mandatory rest. She's slept a lot.
I don't know, probably 16 hours or more. I make it my priority. I didn't sit and chit-chat or dilly-dally. I just took care of dogs, went right back to sleep. Ate, went right back to sleep, so.
Sleep is high on the minds of many mushers during their 24-hour rests. Takotna, with a population of about 50 people, is an ideal place for some mushers to get some quiet. But in the bunkhouse, there's plenty of snoring mushers. Christian Turner has a hack he learned from his 5-month-old daughter.
I put on my baby girl's shusher app in my ears, and it's just like shh, and it just puts me to sleep.
Ramey Smith says a recent cold that clogged his ears means he doesn't have to worry too much about being awakened by other mushers snoring. He says he enjoys everything about Takotna.
The vibe is really nice here, and people are nice, and yeah, you just can't beat Takotna.
Inside the checkpoint, a bustling two-story wood building on the riverbank, there's plenty for mushers to satiate their hunger, too. The community's known for its abundant and delicious pies, which the school and other residents donate for the Iditarod. This is the first time Takotna is a checkpoint in a couple of years due to COVID-19. 37-year resident and local checkpoint manager Tabitha Maglich says it's exciting.
It feels really good to be back.
Still, she says there are community members who are concerned. Maglich says some high-risk people in the community are avoiding the crowds. The tribal council opted out of hosting the Iditarod this year, but voted to allow the race to come through town. Maglich, who's been volunteering with the Iditarod since she was 5 years old, says she stepped up.
Came in to me last minute, and then the council said, we're allowing it, but we're not in charge of it. And I was like, okay, well, I have 2 weeks to get food.
She says based on the tables filled with hamburgers, salmon, cake, and pies, it's worked out. Musher Eric Kelly, getting ready to leave after his 24-hour rest, agrees. He's tested out a variety of the pies.
I had banana cream pie, apple pie, and one I'm not even sure what it was. It was just good.
It's his second year running, but his first on the Iditarod slightly longer southern route, so it'll be new trail for him.
You know, I'm excited. You know, not even nervous.
With some hours of rest and pies filling his belly, he says he's ready for whatever the long stretches of lonely trail ahead throw at him. Reporting from Takotna, I'm Lex Trinan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation. Public media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support.
The The University of Alaska Southeast has a new incoming chancellor. Aparna Palmer was appointed Wednesday. She's currently vice president of Front Range Community College in Colorado. She was previously the assistant vice president for academic affairs at Colorado Mesa University, where she taught biology. At a public forum earlier this year, Palmer said her work as a marine biologist made her especially happy to be in Juneau.
I'm really, really excited to be here between the mountains and the ocean, because this is the biology that excites me the most.
Palmer said her priorities include student recruitment and fiscal stability, and she wants to work with local industries to connect graduates with jobs.
We don't grow if the region doesn't grow. There's a really strong relationship there.
Palmer was born in India and moved to the United States as a child. She said promoting equity and inclusion is personally important to her.
You know, I think about how important it is to me that I have a language that I inherited from my family, and how sad it would be for me if I didn't have that language. And because it's so particular to the way we understand the world.
Palmer's first day as chancellor will be July 1st. She replaces Karen Carey, who is retiring after 3 years on the job. Meanwhile, as Unalaska tries to adapt to the changing climate, the Kalligan tribe is looking for locals with knowledge of the island's berry seasons, bird populations, and more. The tribe is working on an assessment of Unalaska's climate vulnerability, and at a community meeting Wednesday, tribal leaders put out a call for help. Shayla Shishnikov is the Kalligan Resilience Coordinator. She says participants, who will be called community knowledge holders, do not need formal scientific training to serve on the assessment committee.
All of you here and all of you online are members of our community. You are our people. We are the ones who know this land. We are the ones who know our oceans. And so you guys know better than any scientist based out of Anchorage or Homer about what's going on here on the ground.
Participants will be paid to provide information on topics including when seabirds show up, how long berry picking season lasts, and other environmental issues that may demand planning and adaptation. Shishnikov says this guidance will equip local decision makers to better identify threats and challenges driven by climate change.
The local and indigenous knowledge that you have is science, regardless of what other people might say. This is local and indigenous science, traditional ecological knowledge, and this is so valuable.
Six committee members will meet quarterly throughout this year. Shishnikov says the meetings will focus on the concept of Gustilik.
So Gustilik is the Ununga form of visiting. And essentially what that entails is when you get together with your friends, your family, colleagues, anybody, you sit down over coffee or tea, maybe some fish dip or snacks like we have here in the office, and really just create a space for where there's trust and where we're gonna have an organic conversation of knowledge sharing, and really just sitting in a safe, comfortable space.
Those interested can find more information online at kaolungin.com. Ketchikan's tribe is planning to build a substance abuse treatment center in the coming years. It's the first major project for Ketchikan Indian Community's new business arm. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, the tribe hopes to boost the region's treatment capacity as the community struggles with the ongoing opioid epidemic.
Ketchikan Indian Community owns a swath of land about 10 miles north of downtown. It's been set aside for years, and the tribe's new business arm is working to turn it into something big, what it calls a healing center for community members, native or not, with substance abuse issues. Ketchikan, and Southeast Alaska as a whole, has seen a steep rise in opioid-related deaths in the last few years. State health officials tallied 23 opioid-related deaths in Southeast in 2021, the last year that data is available, and 8 were in Ketchikan, with 2 in nearby communities. Advocates have long rallied for more treatment options for the island. Ketchikan Indian Community President Norman Scan says that's the problem the tribe hopes to address.
About 2 years ago, we just saw the trend of the opioid use just getting out of control, in not only in our community, but outlying communities. And we felt like we needed to do our part to help the individuals out.
It'll be the first major project for the Ketchikan Tribal Business Corporation, essentially the business arm of the tribe. The corporation is a so-called IRA Section 17 corporation, named for the section of the Indian Reorganization Act that sets out the rules governing it. It's wholly owned by the tribe, but operates separately. Camille Booth is the corporation's operations manager.
It gives the benefits of being a tribal, with also being able to build revenue in other streams and other areas. So it's very much an economic development arm.
Booth says the corporation is somewhat comparable to regional and village corporations set up by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. But instead of distributing profits to shareholders, dividends could potentially go to Ketchikan Indian community members.
Just like with any corporation, when you have a corporation, then once the company is profitable, then dividends are likely, but the company has to be profitable before dividends are offered.
The corporation has three divisions: commercial, real estate, and government contracting. Booth says the real estate division will focus on leveraging the tribe's existing properties. The government contracting division could provide a variety of services.
And that could be in IT areas, it can be in environmental services, it can be in procurement. There's all sorts of areas of government contracting that fit our type of effort.
The Healing Center is part of a larger initiative dubbed the 10 Mile Project from the corporation's commercial division. The corporation hopes to develop the property with alternative housing for people in recovery, single-family homes, trails, and even tourist attractions and art installations.
It's in phases, of course. And so the first phase would be the Healing Center and actually the Substance Use Disorder Center with housing for that sort of a transitional type housing. And then the next, then it would build into the business area and then into additional housing out there, because it is a very large property.
John Brown is the corporation's vice chair. He says work is still in the beginning stages, and the 16-bed inpatient treatment center, let alone everything else sketched out for the property, won't open its doors for at least 3 years.
They purchased the property and came up with, you know, and again, this was a long-standing thing that they wanted to try to accomplish. And so we are part of that process. And so we're in the process of, again, we're putting ourselves in place so we can do stuff. And then the next phase is, okay, how much funding do we need? Who do we need to contact? And those types of things.
Details of the project are a bit hazy in this early phase of the project. But Booth says she hopes the project will support community members in every stage of their recovery. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George, Jeremy Shea, and Chris Clinton Anchorage, Yvonne Crumry, Claire Strempel, and Katie Anastas in Juneau, Lex Trinan in Takotna, Sophia Stewart-Rassi in Unalaska, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. There are many ways to support your local public media station. Donate now and arrange to make a planned gift as a bequest. Your legacy will stretch from today to many tomorrows. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.